Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, May 25th, 2017. We will be going a little bit out of order, colleagues. We are going to start. I'm going to open a public hearing on 3454.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill.
Erin has lost her voice, so you have to listen very carefully when she speaks.
3454 requires school districts that participate in National School Lunch Program provide students who ask with lunch, regardless of whether student can pay money or owes money.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike McLean, and I represent House District 55 in the legislature. I'm pleased to be joined by my co-chief sponsor of this bill, Representative Brian Clem. This bill is to ban lunch shaming. And while, thankfully, lunch shaming at schools in Oregon is rare, it has been an objectionable process for a long time. And in other states, they're passing statutes to prevent it. And I heard about some of the stories one night while watching the news and being informed with a bunch of news commentaries from a variety of networks. I saw that this was actually a common problem on red and blue states. So for an example, let me quote one media that said, known broadly as lunch shaming, it allows states to single out or school districts children as young as four who are unable to come up with the money for hot school meals. So the reality is we do have, and in fact there is a school district in Oregon, Madam Chair, your school district actually, that does by its policy allow the use of a stamp on a hand or gentle, what they call gentle verbal reminders when a student who is not on free lunch program but whose guardians or parents have not paid the lunch bill. The student is singled out and reminded to have their parents pay the bill, even to the extent of not allowing the student to eat lunch but giving the student as an alternative meal of, quote, milk, fruit, and vegetables. Well, I know that is an excellent meal for Representative Hack in her constant triathlon training. But for the rest of the kids, when you could be having lasagna or something hot, that is, you're singled out, and that's embarrassing. So it's called lunch shaming. And collection tactics by having kids singled out is just something we want to nip in the bud. And again, I don't think it is large spread. I don't think our school districts mean to do something that's improper, but it does occur. And this bill would simply say that you cannot use a collection tactic of denying a child what they've already been signed up to get. They've requested the hot lunch. They're in line to get it. You can't deny it, them the lunch. You can't use them as a collection tactic for the parents. So that's all it does. Now, I've asked here to be with me Brian Clem, because Brian Clem is known as the lunch guy in the legislature, not because he
is the Oregonian,
a robust user of the member lounge. Not because he reminds all of us of the famous Chris Farley skit of Lunch Lady, but because he has worked tirelessly to make sure that our kids have access to healthy lunches with his farm-to-school programs and others. So I asked Brian to join me in this effort, and I'm very grateful to have him as a co-chief.
Thank you, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, House District 21. Not really that tall, but I am paunchy. I read that in the paper over the weekend, and I'm here to talk about school lunches, healthy school lunches. And as many of you have helped us with over the years, we've really done something wonderful in Oregon. We've become the leading state in the union at providing Oregon-grown or in-state-grown produce meats to our kids. We're the farm-to-school capital of the United States. We have 25% of all foods served in our lunchroom are grown in the state that they're eaten in by the kids. And so in general, we have made fascinatingly incredible progress with very little investment really from the state in becoming a place where lunch is a very positive experience, very fun. People have often grown something in the garden and then later they have it in their lunchroom. And so when Representative McClain talked to me about this bill, I realize that it is possible that the kids end up unfortunately paying the price because their parents haven't paid the bill. And I did check online and saw a policy of one of our school districts that did talk about some ways to get at the lack of payment by the parents that did put the kid in the middle of it. Use of a stamp that kind of to remind the kid that when they get home, the parent sees the stamp. Well, the other kids also see the stamp, and it makes them feel awkward because they're the only one with a stamp that my parents are deadbeat. Little reminders that other kids would certainly overhear are allowed according to this policy, this alternate meal. And I just want the schools to get their money, but I want them to get it by dealing directly with the parents. And if they have to through a collection agency or phone calls to their house, that's fine. But being picked out from the crowd is already happening, of course, in the schools, and this is one reason I would like to get off the list of reasons that you might be embarrassed in front of your classmates. Now, having now had this bill out there for a week or something, I did see some testimony from Portland Public Schools, I think, that Representative Daugherty furnished you all, and in it at the end they said, we did have a stamp, but we are going to stop doing that. So that's one positive outcome of even having this bill out there in a hearing. I would like to hope that we don't have a ton of people doing it. They didn't feel it was meant to be shaming, but they did worry about the misinterpretation of their intent, and so it sounds like they aren't going to have the stamp anymore. But I think it's important that we don't have it anywhere in the state, and so that's why I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3454 and be happy to entertain any questions with my colleague.
Thank you very much. Philip Kennedy Wong, Helen Bank.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Oregon Food Bank. I'm here representing our support for House Bill 3454, and I want to extend our thanks to Representative McClain and Representative Clem. I do have to come clean. I do have two kids in Portland Public Schools, and my youngest daughter, I owe 50 cents on her school lunch card, because the way it works in Portland Public Schools, you get this card, they put money on it when you need it, and sometimes they'll put money on it when, on occasion, like your child forgets and leaves her lunch on the kitchen counter, which does happen from time to time. But the point that I'm trying to make, just in terms of overall, is when you look at, you know, some of the challenges that parents face and the schedules and the demands they have, especially those who are qualified for the reduced price. So that means they're not qualified for the free lunch, but they're qualified for the reduced price. It doesn't mean necessarily they have all the resources it takes to raise a family in today's world. It is very, very expensive. And, you know, I remember when I had one child in school and the other in child care, it was very expensive, and there were a lot of things to keep track of, and obviously trying to hold down a job at the same time. So having said all of that, we all know that when a child goes through some sort of singling out, it could have some long-term repercussions, especially as they move into adolescence, and there could be some challenges with respect to how they handle that from an emotional and intellectual level, and how they internalize what it means if they're being singled out, as they're still trying to learn themselves and their relationship to the world. And obviously, you know, there's always that risk for that child to, you know, move in a downward path, which is not something that we want to see happen. So one of the things that that we see a lot in the food banking world is that for adults, there's still a lot of shame and shaming that goes with people who find themselves needing to go to a food bank to make ends meet. We've heard countless stories of people who have parked outside of a school pantry but couldn't bring themselves to go into the pantry because they felt ashamed to go ask for help. And over time, you know, when some of our food pantry staff or volunteers see this individual, you know, from day to day, you know, they will engage that person. And then we learn and find out, you know, one of the reasons holding them back had been that personal shame. So for us, when you look at, you know, where does that begin, where does that start? Well, you know, potentially it could start if there is a lunch shaming sort of culture that begins at a very early age, i.e. our school children. So for us, this is an ongoing effort to sort of educate people that we shouldn't use hunger and poverty as a way to divide us and to look down on people. We should use hunger as a way to unite us in common cause, because we share a lot more to gain by working together to fight hunger. So one thing I would like to do, I do want to introduce a partner agency of ours, Helen Vank, who has extensive experience working for Metropolitan Family Services in the school setting with respect to food and the role that it plays in the services that Metropolitan Family Services provides. Thank you very much.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Helen Vank. I am the Program Quality Coordinator for Metropolitan Family Service and our Community Schools Program. What we do in our Community Schools Program is we try to support the child and their needs as they achieve their highest academic potential. And we do that outside of the academic school day setting. So we do after school programs, before school day, summer school, event classes, parent classes, that sort of thing. And what we've seen is that students are able to reach their highest academic potential when they have their needs met, when they're healthy and fed, when they have enough time to sleep at night. And also we see positive gains when their parents have a positive relationship with the school and they feel comfortable interacting with the school and the school staff. We also see positive gains when the students themselves have a positive relationship with the school day. They want to be at school, and they want they have trusted adults in the school building. So if you think about it from how you're spending your money, is shaming a child, alienating them, setting them up to be noticed and possibly teased by their friends worth it? And that's an anxiety that they have when they're sitting in the classroom looking at the clock thinking, lunch is about to come. I don't think I have money in my account. Am I going to get the stamp today? Am I going to have to wear this bracelet? Are they going to give me the cheese sandwich instead of the warm meal so that everyone knows I can't do that? That's learning time lost. And when we think about the funding that we have for our schools, what we pay for our staff, what we pay for our curriculum, is that $2 that they're missing out of their lunch account worth a student missing possibly an afternoon of learning because they're so anxious about if they're going to be able to eat lunch that day? And then what is that relationship going forward with the school, with their attitude towards coming to school, wanting to be at school and learning? And also, what's the relationship that they have with the parents and their school? Is that an adversarial relationship where the school's trying to go after and collect money? Or is it a supportive relationship where the school is working with the parent to help possibly fill out paperwork that they didn't know that they qualified for, or to find some other resource? So that's what we do in our community schools program, is try to look, how can we get these parents involved? How can we build these positive relationships with the families and with the schools, especially knowing that families in poverty are struggling to do all they can to meet those needs? And in the end, we're working for the highest possible academic success of the child, and I don't think lunch shaming is in that realm. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. John Mullen and Soren Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. As members are aware, the mission of the Oregon Law Center is to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities. And we're happy today to be in solidarity with our hunger partners to talk about this issue. I don't think I need to say very much more other than what has been said previously, and to recommend that you take a look at Matt Newell Ching's letter on OLIS from Partnership for a Hunger-Free Oregon. I'm just really very pleased to see this bipartisan strong support for something that may seem like a small thing in the scheme of things, but it means a lot to individual families and individual children. I happened to hear the NPR story on the way down to work today. Some of you may have heard it about former heavyweight champion George Foreman, who was very poor growing up, and he was shamed in another way about going to school, not having food at all and not having a lunch program at that time. And he'd bring an empty bag to school just so that he wouldn't be teased by other people. So I think this is a very good bill, very simple solution. And again, you've heard from the experts on this, but we are happy to stand in solidarity. Thank you.
Hello, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Soren Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association, representing school support personnel, including lunch ladies around the state. And we're here today in support of House Bill 3454. I don't want to repeat a lot of what was already said. I would just add that in talking to other education advocates on this bill and stakeholders, I think there may still be a little bit of work that we can do on this bill in terms of amendments to address some of the unfunded mandates. But otherwise, like I said, OSCA, we're in support of House Bill 3454. Thank you.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3454. And colleagues, we do not have all the paperwork, so I'm going to carry the work session over to our Tuesday meeting. Next, I'm going to open a work session on 3434.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3434 was originally heard on May 2nd. It extends the sunset date for the Public Safety Fiscal Emergency Program for counties through January 2nd, 2024. We did receive a fiscal impact statement, which is indeterminate, as well as a revenue impact statement that is indeterminate.
Thank you.
Right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3434 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 3434 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Leininger. I will close the work session on House Bill 3434 and will open a public hearing on House Bill 3461.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3461 provides Attorney General with increased enforcement authority over contraband cigarette sales in conjunction with non-participating manufacturer adjustment settlement related to tobacco master settlement agreement.
Okay. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 3461. Which pertains to Oregon's enforcement of our obligations under the Master Settlement Agreement. In the late 1990s, Oregon joined the overwhelming majority of states in entering into litigation with tobacco companies for the explosion of health-related difficulty related to tobacco use. In 1998, we joined with 46 of those states in entering into the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. The Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement may be familiar to many of you because it is the vehicle by which we receive the so-called tobacco money, which is a varying amount, usually $80 to $90 million received annually. That money does not come without obligations. The basic idea of the Master Settlement Agreement is that while the larger tobacco companies did enter into that settlement, not every tobacco producing company anywhere did. So we are obligated as a state to a complex sort of lattice work of regulations that make sure that those who did sign on are not unduly disadvantaged relative to those who did not. And that's a continuing obligation that we've had ever since the 90s. And in order to guarantee the receipt of those funds, we have to maintain a continually robust regulatory environment. Now, this requirement is in the terms of the Master Settlement Agreement, and it has generated litigation over the years. That litigation is often aimed at sort of teasing out that question of whether the regulations are adequate. We have been in, and that's done in an annual certification. Now, if you fail to meet the terms of the master settlement agreement, as determined through arbitration, you can lose some or even all of the money that you would receive through the master settlement agreement. That's a significant amount of money, so the litigation is important. We have been in negotiations with the tobacco companies regarding a portion of those negotiations. And as part of those settlement discussions, we come before you with a bill that is designed to maintain the robust regulatory environment that we need to continue that we have access as a state to these tobacco funds going forward. In addition, some of the changes that are contemplated by this bill have the effect of actually protecting Oregon consumers insofar as much of what we do here is designed to regulate the smaller companies, many of which are overseas, sales done over the internet or by phone that are not otherwise regulated, and that those products can be different than I think what we think of as standard cigarettes. They can have a higher burn point. They can be less carefully regulated in their country of origin. So there's a consumer incentive to making sure that we maintain the sanctity of this agreement, as well as a financial one. I'd like to introduce Lisa Udlin. She is the chief counsel of our civil enforcement division and definitely our smart person on the master settlement agreement. We did introduce a fairly extensive breakdown of the impact of this bill on OLIS, and we will try to keep our remarks brief, but we are happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Udland. As Aaron stated, I'm chief counsel of the Department of Justice's Civil Enforcement Division. Just short background, I have been practicing in the area of tobacco law since 2003, and so I've seen a lot of what has gone on in our enforcement. Under the MSA, Oregon was required to enact and diligently enforce statutes known as the qualifying statute or the escrow statute. Those are found at ORS 323.800 to 323.806. These require the Quebec, as Aaron stated, these require the tobacco companies who do not join the MSA or non-participating manufacturers to make payments into an escrow account, which is an approximation of the MSA payment they would have made had they joined the MSA. In the 2003 session, this legislature helped us to enact complementary legislation, which helped us assist with the enforcement of the escrow obligation. Those statutes are located at ORS 180-400 to 180-455. They provide the Department of Justice will maintain a directory of tobacco products approved for stamping and sale in Oregon. In other words, if you want to sell tobacco products in Oregon, you must be on the directory. To be placed on the directory, a manufacturer must file a certification with the Department of Justice, including proof that the manufacturer is in compliance with state, federal, and local law and all of Oregon's escrow statutes. Furthermore, distributors cannot sell products in Oregon if they're not listed on this directory. The escrow statute and complementary legislation are enforced by our Department of Justice staff, and we worked closely with the Department of Revenue in that effort. As Aaron mentioned, we had been engaged in some protracted litigation with the tobacco companies regarding our diligent enforcement efforts. Under the MSA, there are a number of complicated upward and downward payment adjustments, and one of those is the MPM adjustment related to non-participating manufacturers. The MSA allows tobacco companies to withhold money from our payment organs' payment each year if they dispute our diligent enforcement, the tobacco companies had been doing that to the tune of about $9 to $10 million a year since the year 2007. In 2013, we litigated the issue regarding whether we were diligent in calendar year 2003. We won and received our full payment in 2014. But as under the MSA, that litigation isn't over because that dispute is a year-by-year dispute, and that dispute will continue on into perpetuity. Because litigation over this issue is time-consuming as well as costly and carries a very large downside risk, which is the loss of our entire payment in any given year, we recently joined 22 other states settling the dispute for the years 2004 through 2015. We received approximately $60 million in funds that had been previously withheld. And as a result, we also agreed to slightly broaden our enforcement responsibilities, which brings us to this bill. The primary changes in this bill are to give the Attorney General sources of additional recovery if a manufacturer fails to make their required escrow payment. We do that through importer liability and a bonding requirement. Several of our largest MPM manufacturers are foreign manufacturers. their U.S. importer controls their market and which markets their products are shipped to, and adds another layer in the distribution chain of enforcement between the manufacturer and the state. It can be difficult often to enforce against a foreign entity. This bill would assist us by requiring an importer who is profiting from these sales to take responsibility jointly with the manufacturer. In addition, the bill has a bonding requirement which gives the state a source of recovery in the event that an MPM files for bankruptcy or otherwise defaults on their obligation, and would allow us to avoid the necessity of looking for assets in other states or even other countries in the event of a default. The bill includes additional changes such as a ban on internet sales, which helps ensure that foreign entities are not able to avoid the Oregon taxation scheme. We have seen cigarettes from places such as Moldova, Israel, and Russia. They often do not have, are not fire safe. They sometimes don't pay taxes. We've also seen instances where children are able to get around the age verification requirements. And so this bill would require face-to-face sales. In addition, the bill would require, will allow DOJ to have enforced investigation authority and ability to gather evidence, and will allow for data sharing to assist us in implementing the terms of the settlement agreement. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Philip Morris. Philip Morris is one of the original participating manufacturers in the MSA, and we have worked over the years, including in 2003, closely with DOJ to craft the NPM legislation and to refine it. This is another step in that effort. I would say, as I've mentioned to DOJ, we will have a couple of technical amendments for your consideration and for DOJ's consideration. So we would simply urge that that you defer the work session until we've got the paperwork back from our legal department.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair McLean.
Yeah, Aaron, is that okay with the DOJ to pause for that amendment?
Chair Williamson, Representative McLean, absolutely. They gave us advance notice, and we're looking forward to hearing from them.
All right, thank you.
Questions? All right, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3461. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill. What? Oh, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2131.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2131, I will direct your attention to the summary of the Dash 5 amendment. It replaces the measure, requires state fire marshal plan for rail transport hazardous material emergency response to include system for identifying oil spill or release response resources owned by railroads and where they are located. It creates a financial responsibility statement that's applicable to rail carrier that must submit to the state fire marshal that demonstrates rail carrier's ability to pay cost of cleanup. It adds contingency plan for high hazard train route to definition of contingency plans in Department of Environmental Quality statutes. It requires railroad that owns or operates high hazard train route to have oil spill prevention and emergency response plan. Plan is to be submitted to DEQ for review. It specifies factors DEQ must consider when reviewing and approving contingency plan. Requires contingency plan be renewed once every 5 years. Environmental Quality Commission is required to adopt rules standardizing preparation of high hazard train route contingency plans. Rules are to be, to the extent feasible and appropriate, consistent with plans adopted by State Fire Marshal for oil or hazardous material spills or release, and by DEQ for pipeline spill contingency plans. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it takes effect 91st day after signing die.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. I have been in this room before talking about oil trains. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I'm going to spend a few minutes today kind of walking you through how we got to this bill, review some work that this legislature did in the 2015 session, talk a little bit about the Mosier incident and some lessons we learned from that, and then walk you through where we are on my amendments that I'm going to ask you to move today, as well as some alternative amendments as well. So, there are a number of items on OLIS that I will be referencing as I go throughout, and please feel free to ask me questions as you go or as I go. So, to review, as we all know, there has been an increase in the last 6 to 8 years of the transport of oil by rail in Oregon. There's a little graph in OLIS that shows the increase since 2005. You can see the peak so far was in 2014, where we had about over 24,000 carloads transported through the state. And this year, we're only up to 2016, we only got to about 10,000. But if you look back, that's still significantly higher than it has been in the past. So the safety of transporting oil by rail has been an increasing concern since this has been going on all throughout the country. There also has been concern with a lot of conversation about a potential terminal in Vancouver, Washington, increasing it that way. And Oregon, I always say for good and for bad, is a pass-through state. Oregon does not have any refineries. So oil just goes through the state and doesn't stop at any refineries, which has long limited our abilities to assess fees in order to do any sort of planning. So in 2015, this body passed House Bill 3225. It focused on hazmat training and preparedness of local responders, did not address environmental concerns or require planning from the railroads. So 3225, basically, it gave the state fire marshal the authority to adopt a plan by rule for the coordinated response to oil or hazardous spills during rail transport. This lets them both coordinate local first responder plans and also put together all local, state, and federal plans that we have. They also got the authority to require and incentivize training, to identify where response equipment was located. We also established the Oil and Hazardous Material Transparency by Rail Fund. We set up a new coordinator position in the Fire Marshal Office. And we worked very closely with the railroads that run oil trains through our state. Union Pacific and BNSF, and I always get their initials wrong, so I'm just going to say BNSF, as well as Pacific and Portland and Western, which is the Class 2. They committed to collaborating with the fire marshal in this work, provided foam trailers, training, scholarships, all sorts of good things like that. Then, June 3rd, 2016, it would have been more dramatic if I turned that on then, almost a year ago now, we had the incident in Mosier. I'm just going to flip through these briefly, and then we can turn it back off, but we had the incident in Mosier where a Union Pacific Railroad unit train consisting of 94 tank cars with Bakken crude derailed in Mosier along the Columbia River. A total of 16 cars derailed, resulting in a release of product with a subsequent fire. So I always find this very striking that somebody had the forethought to get that with look, this thing works. Just a couple pictures from the situation, and then that to give you a sense of the follow-up cleanup work that was done away from the site of the derailment. So the fire involved one car and spread to involve a total of three cars. Overall, about 47,000 gallons of product spilled. It also caused some secondary damage to the Mosier wastewater plant, and there was an evacuation done for about half a mile around there. So what did we learn from that Mosier incident? First of all, it was a good reminder of the different agency roles and responsibilities in responding to this kind of an incident. The fire marshal's main objective in an event like Mosier is to indeed protect life and safety immediately after an oil spill or a release. So it's what you typically think of when thinking of a first responder. They administer training and are building on the authority that we gave them in 2015 with House Bill 3225. And indeed, a centralized training had been held within a few weeks before the Mosier incident. And there was a lot of talk about how that had been, unfortunately or fortunately, a great kind of training ground for a lot of the work they ended up doing in Mosier. So the fire marshal's role was also coordinating the statewide hazardous material training response teams. Then DEQ also has a role in this. So DEQ's roles kind of are before anything happens. Their role is for pre-planning response strategies to reduce the impact to public, natural, and cultural resources. During an incident, they have a responsibility to work with state and local partners to make sure that a quick and effective response is rolled out that will hopefully reduce damage and save time and money. And then after the incident, DEQ is then the lead agency overseeing the cleanup. And as we have had demonstrated here, that cleanup often lasts long after the initial incident. So DEQ is the state agency responsible for coordinating the cleanup, has an on-site coordinator during the incident, and then works closely all throughout the process. So our takeaway on agency roles and responsibilities was that in 2015, in House Bill 3225, we did give the fire marshal some authority and resources, but we did not really address DEQ's role in oil spill planning or response. The other couple significant takeaways from our response to the Mosher incident were contingency plans. That we had, we were told repeatedly that the contingency plans on the Washington side were much more thorough and that we needed better contingency plans on the Oregon side. In addition, geographic response plans. Now, contingency plans talk about the railroad's preparation, what they have ready for the transport of these trains. Geographic response plans are something that are developed by DEQ. They identify, as I mentioned earlier, sensitive natural, cultural, or significant economic resources, environmental resources, excuse me, and they describe and prioritize response strategies in an effort to minimize injury to those resources at risk from oil spills. So right now, the state only has geographic response plans for along the Columbia River, the Willamette River, and areas of the Pacific. We do not have geographic response plans for along a majority of rail routes in the state. And there is another item in OLIS that is a map that very roughly shows where we have those geographic response plans now and where we don't. Tragically, despite my good planning. So that is this map that you have in your, so you can see the circled parts are the rail routes where we do not have geographic response plans, current ones now. So, and then the final thing that this incident made us aware of was the need to establish financial responsibility, and does a railroad have the ability to cover a worst case spill scenario? Now, Mosher was far from a worst case, as we've talked about before. We honestly got quite lucky on the weather that day that it wasn't as windy as usual, that it didn't happen in a slightly different place, that the fire didn't go, more cars didn't catch on fire, the fire didn't move to the school, et cetera. But it was really, I guess I could say a wake-up call, but as we talked about in 2015, the concern was we were going to have an incident like this, and we did. So we learned some good lessons from there. I want to take a side note and point out that in 2015, when we were passing House Bill 3225, the state of Washington also passed a bill about oil trains. It was House Bill 1449, and that bill required railroads to complete and submit contingency plans, those same contingency plans that we realized through Mosher that we did not have sufficiently on our side of the river, to their State Department of Ecology. That bill also required railroads to demonstrate proof of financial responsibility, and they were able to pay for this with a tax on oil coming through the refineries. As I mentioned before, we don't have that ability. Because we don't have refineries, we are not able to assess that kind of a tax. However, that Washington statutory approach, the approach they took is they took the statutory authority that is already that they have, that Oregon has under what's called the Oil Protection Act. The Oil Protection Act has already long established requirements for contingency planning for other oil conveyors, for boats, for pipelines. It's been in statute for, I believe, over 20 years. And so Washington said, very much as our first draft in 2015 did, and very much what we're doing in 2131 now, said, let's put a definition, expand the definition under the Oil Protection Act of these rail cars carrying oil through the state. And then the way Washington did it is they defined the railroads, a railroad not owned by the state that transports oil in bulk as cargo, as a facility that had to file these plans, and then said the department by rule shall determine that contingency plan. So in 2015, when we ended up with 3225 here, and Washington passed 1449, I'm sorry this isn't in OLIS yet, but I wanted to read you a quote from an OPB story about this. It's a story about the parallel bills that happened in Washington and Oregon. The requirement for emergency response plans was contentious, Farrell said. The railroad industry lobbied simultaneously against similar bills in the Oregon and Washington state legislatures. The same representatives for railroads and the petroleum industry appeared on panels together in both states using similar talking points in their testimony. They advised lawmakers in both states that the legislation under consideration resembled rules that prompted UP and BNSF to sue the state of California. The railroads argued that federal law prohibited California calling for railroads to submit spill contingency plans and to prove that they can cover the cost of an oil train spill. Last year, a federal judge dismissed the suit. This may have been 2 years ago now. So my point in reading that is, despite testifying against the bill in our original bill in 2015 and what we've had in conversations so far this year, Washington passed legislation that requires railroads under the same statutes, the Oil Protection Act, that we utilize in this bill today. Washington passed that bill. They went through a long rulemaking process, and all four railroads that ship oil through Washington have made these contingency plans, same kind of plans we are asking for here, and submitted them to the Washington Department of Ecology. I confirmed this with the Washington Department of Ecology this week. So they are all submitting them to the state of Washington. So that brings me to the Dash 5 amendments, which I have before you today. Their basic components is it expands the training and exercise authority that we gave to the fire marshal in 2015. It requires railroads to demonstrate their ability to cover the costs associated with a worst-case spill. It includes rail, as I mentioned, it includes rail with other transporters of oil who submit environmental contingency plans to DEQ. We've worked extensively with legislative council on this, and the truth is, railroad law is a very challenging area in which to work. It's preemption, the federal preemption is very strong, and it's very much a case-by-case basis. And so we have worked very thoroughly with legislative council to make sure that the language we are using is designed specifically to fit as an allowable expansion of the state's powers under the oil, I say this word all the wrong all the time, under the Oil Protection Act. There are things you can't do to railroads. You can't say you have to do this or you can't come through the state. We talk about this plan as being submitted. It's not a requirement. We specifically say in the language, not having done this will not prohibit you from running a train through the state. We worked very hard to be as clear as possible that this was a reasonable expansion of the Oil Protection Act, and that it would not be federally preempted. Is it still open to debate? Of course it is, because that's how railroad law works. Like I said, it's very driven. It's driven by court cases, and there is not clear language on this. The California suit that was filed against California language was dismissed, but for a totally different reason, and so it never addressed this specifically. So we continue to believe that we are in a very strong legal position on this. The Dash 5 ensures that the rail oil spill contingency plans are added to and coordinated with the state fire marshal's compilation of local, state, and federal plans. It expands DEQ's geographic response plan mapping to include sensitive areas along those high hazard train routes circled that we do not currently have. And it also establishes a dedicated high hazard train route oil spill prevention fund for the DEQ's work related to rail with contingency planning and geographic response planning. This is important because there are also very strict federal railroad laws that talk about you can't share resources between money that is given by rail can't be shared with other resources. So we have worked very hard to define this as strongly as possible to make sure that the resources from rail are only used for rail going forward. So The kind of big picture on the approach of the Dash Fives is this. It puts the responsibility of that planning, of that geographic response, of the contingency planning on the railroads. Given the local needs and the state authority that we have under the Oil Pollution Act, we have added owners and operators of high hazard train routes to the existing contingency plan statutes of the DEQ, as I mentioned, that have been in statute for many years. Now, the railroads will argue that this extension is federally preempted, but as I mentioned, this issue has not directly been litigated. It's a gray area, and we believe strongly that we've worked very hard to have as strong a thing as possible. And indeed, from our LC opinion, the goal in preparing these amendments was to amend the laws in a manner that would arguably constitute a proper expansion and exercise of state authority under the OPA. And to be clear, that said, the arguments presented in the California case were based on reasonable interpretations of the law also. Given the resolution of that, because it was decided on something else, it's still an open question as to whether the amendments to Oregon's statutes will be determined by court, because, of course, there's no way to know beforehand. And I just want to say one more time, this that we are asking for in the Dash Fives is what they do in Washington and what all four railroads that are operating oil trains in that state are currently submitting to the state of Washington. There's some Scribner's, a few Scribner issues that I'm happy to resolve at Ways and Means. We were asked by the Fire Marshal's office to consistently call the Fire Marshal office one thing or another. The drafter picked one, and then the Fire Marshal said, well, actually, we'd rather have the other. So we need to, everywhere it says State Fire Marshal, it needs to say Office of the State Fire Marshal. And we plan to remove ethanol from the definition of oil. That was this is when my lawyer facade really breaks down, and you can't tell that I'm actually a lawyer. All right, you can tell that I'm actually not a lawyer. compounding? Okay, never mind. I'll come back to it. I do want to point out that there is also Dash 8 amendment online. What is the C word? It's going to drive me crazy, you guys.
Oh.
Conflating. No, I do like that word also. But so there are also the Dash 8 amendments in OLIS. They also have a lot of the same components, okay? They add the Fire Marshal authority. They add to the Fire Marshal authority from 2015 like we did. They allow the Fire Marshal. But here's the significant difference. They allow the Fire Marshal to ask for a specific list of information from the railroad, and as part of that, they can also ask for proof of financial responsibility to cover an oil spill. However, in the Dash 8s, there's no threshold or worst-case spill they have to demonstrate, and it expands DEQ's ability to do those geographic response plans. However, the onus, as they say, this puts the responsibility for the planning on the state, not on the railroads. I think that is a significant difference. I believe that we need a coordinated West Coast response. California requires these plans. Washington requires these plans. I will reference another lovely thing in OLIS that lays out California, Washington, and Oregon and what the requirements are in each of the states. And ours are all the ones that say no. Now, the ability to tax on oil by rail, that's gonna keep being a no because we don't have those things where you do oil. Okay, so the real difference in approach here is who's doing the planning. The Dash 8s would allow us to ask for information. The Dash 5s that I am asking you to move put the planning responsibility on the railroad and have them provide the information to be included in our state compilation. I could not more strongly believe that we need to do everything within our ability to plan and prepare for another spill. We were lucky, extremely lucky, that Mosher was not worse. You also may hear about some new federal rules that are pending about oils, preparation for this. Couple things. This has been in the works for years. This was argued in the 2014 case against the California law. The railroads argued, well, you've got new federal laws coming up right away. Well, that was 3 years ago, and they're still not out. And with a new administration, anytime you have a change in administration, it slows down the rulemaking process because you have new staff, all of that, and we don't know where this administration is going to go in this process. And while there may be new federal rules, I don't think we can wait for them to come out before we do this. And finally, we got a preliminary opinion from LC that in which they believe that we will still have the ability to do this under the Oil Protection Act regardless. I promise I'm almost done. I'm sure there are members back there who would like to come and talk. Again, we need a consistent West Coast approach on this. Both Washington and California led the way on this work in 2015. Railroads in Washington have submitted their contingency plans, and the Dash 5 does it the same way as Washington did it by adding to the OPA. Safety is a bipartisan goal here. I believe that Mosher demonstrated that this continues to be an if, not a when. We began planning for that when in 2015, and we need to continue that preparation with House Bill 2131 and the Dash 5 approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Oh, that was so much longer than I thought.
Questions?
Sorry.
Can I ask
a
question?
She can move up to the dais.
Can I ask a question?
I would love for you to ask a question.
Thank you, colleague. Representative, and thank you for your work. I know you've worked very hard.
Even though I'm not a lawyer.
And sometimes that's better because common sense is not confined to those who graduate from law school. In fact, seldom found. And you mentioned that you base this language on the state of Washington, and that language has not been tested in court, correct?
That is correct.
So we don't know whether it's preempted or not.
We do not.
So do we have LFO or anybody looking at what would be the cost of the state to defend this statute should a rail company sue?
I certainly have not asked that. I am continuing to stay focused on the fact that Washington has implemented this successfully and that indeed the railroads are submitting their plans there.
May I follow up? It sounds like they chose not to sue yet in Washington, and for some reason they didn't challenge it here. I am concerned, while many fine attorneys work with the Department of Justice and their contracting attorneys are certainly high caliber. I know from a litigation involved with Cover Oregon that the cost of litigation was tens of millions of dollars. And I am concerned about that. I'm also concerned about enforcement. Under your provision, if the railway, because you make it on number the Dash 8, which Representative Johnson has, and you're the Dash 5. And under the Dash 5, you've presented it that the railroad companies produce information, come up with a plan. I guess my question is, who determines on whether that plan is adequate or what's the standard by which compliance? Are we going to have somebody looking over the plan and saying not good enough, do it again?
Right. Well, there is a long, Madam Chair, Vice Chair McLean, there's a longstanding practice with these contingency plans. Again, the EQC has been reviewing them regularly that are provided by the pipelines, that are provided by the by the boat folks. There is a long established process. It would be a combination of, and I believe we call it out in there, the EQC, the fire marshal. These also would be shared with the tribes, specifically that whose lands these rail cars go through. It's an established process that has worked very successfully in our other contingency planning, and the belief is that because that's both that it's been established in the other parts of the Oil Protection Act, and honestly, because they've gone through this in Washington and have a pretty good model to work off of there as well, there is a hope and belief that will establish that.
Can I ask one last question?
Sure, and then we'll have Representative Johnson present his.
And I'm looking forward to it because he's quite an exceptional legislator.
He's quite compelling.
And roommate.
He is a good roommate.
Good to know.
A couple of things. When the contingency plan, in your mind, is the railroad doing it, or are they just simply cutting the check for it to be done by government affiliates?
No, no, not at all. The contingency plans are specifically done by the railroads. It's quite thorough. It's okay. There's kind of in Washington they came up through the rules of an established list on what it was going to cover. It's all in, to give the railroads full credit on this. It's all information that you know that they have and that they compile. And the idea is to make sure that there is kind of full accountability along all these routes. That because the sharing of the information is what can be a challenge. And I believe that it's important for us to be able to have them sharing consistent kinds of information as because so many of these trains do go through along the West Coast, and for us to have those same contingency plans provided to Oregon that are provided already to California and Washington.
So my last follow-up then is, who would implement? In other words, the private sector is providing contingency plans to be implemented by the government.
Not really. No, the contingency plans themselves are not things that are done. They are, you know, it is literally a list of, and I can grab this and get it. It is okay. Here's a list of all of our contractors along the route and contact information for them, for our contracted extra firefighters and whatever. It is the supplies that we have to respond to things. It is all that. It's a planning document so that when an incident happens, you can go to the part where it's happening and say, okay, so here's who their contractors are in that region. Let's get them connected so that it's all in one place. The plan itself comes from the railroad. It isn't really implemented by anybody. It is a planning tool. It's to have on file. It's updated every, I think, 5 years. It is so that when God forbid another Mosher happens, we have the information is there in one place. Beyond the information that the fire marshal right now asks for and puts together.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Great to be here. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson from House District 52. And I'll be much briefer. Just because I think our good representative has framed the issue, I think, very well. And let me just begin by saying, you know, as someone who Mosher didn't happen in my district, but the smoke blew into my district, so it was very, very close. It's probably 3 miles away from where my district actually ends. It was in Representative Huffman's district. But my point would be, I'm very close to the issue, and my constituents and my people in the gorge are very concerned about the issue. And we want safety, and we want responses, but we want them to be implementable. And I think that's where I think myself and the good representative may part company, because I think what she's proposing in her version of House Bill 2131, and I think even in the dash fives, although the dash fives aren't improvement or the dash twos, I think, which initially came out, I think there are still issues with legal enforcement here. And from my perspective, and I think the majority of my constituents, if we're going to pass additional legislation, we really want this to be able to be effective and to not put the state of Oregon in legal jeopardy to have to spend resources defending. And I'll just go through a few items that I think where we still have some issues with the dash fives, in that I think DEQ is still given response authority to, if the plan that is submitted by the railroads is not satisfactory, I think DEQ still has the ability to regulate rail based on their perspective of the plans itself. I think the section five of the plan of the dash fives, I think, in the definition of high hazard train routes, meaning that virtually any section of train that has a tanker on it that has crude on it is designated as a high hazard train route, which would be all rail in the state of Oregon, because I think you not just in sensitive areas but throughout the state. Via that same language, I guess I'm wondering why all of our state highways aren't also designated as high hazard roads, because we have equally as flammable and equally as potentially damaging, you know, substances traveling. I'm not suggesting that we should. I just think this definition opens up that avenue. Let me just go through something else, and I'll cut to what I think Representative McLean may have been asking the question about, and that is, what is the standard that should by which all of these plans should be measured? And the representative touched on this, but on August 1st, the Federal Transportation Federal Rail Administration will be issuing the federal rules regarding
comprehensive oil spill response plans, and they're in OLIS. If you want to look at that testimony that actually has my name next to it, I would encourage you to look at that. The rule announcement of this was only just a year ago, actually, on July 13th, where they made notice of this. So this process has been in place for the next year, and via federal legislation, the rule will come out on August 1st. But my position would be that this will be the preeminent, this will have preemption over any other state's plans when these rules are issued on August the 1st. Let me just touch on some of these bullet points in here. These are going to list the requirements for comprehensive plans. The railroads are going to be required to address worst case discharge. They're going to have to resources about response resources, notification procedures. They're going to have to list training. They're going to have to talk about plan update procedures. They're going to have to talk about approval procedures. This is very, very substantive, and I would be willing to put this up against the Washington plan or any other California plan and say this is at least as rigorous, if not more. But the point is this will have federal preemption. So my point would be, why would we as a state want to start down a potential pathway that could end us in legal jeopardy when there will be a federal plan very soon? And I know that the good representative says we shouldn't put hope in waiting for the federal government, but via legislation that passed federally, this is supposed to be out on August the 1st. So that would be my, in a nutshell. But let me just touch on four points that we tried to address with our Dash 8s. And again, let me just, passing House Bill 3225 in the last session was incredibly important. When the Mosier incident happened, the state fire marshal picked up the phone, made a notification, and people knew what to do because they had trained for it. And the response worked flawlessly. It worked very, very well. But the state fire marshal, in testimony in front of our committee, listed some things that needed to be addressed as well. They include requirements for contingency plans to be filed by rail with OSFM, to be filed with rail. Allow state ride response exercise planning and execution by the state fire marshal, as noted as one of their holes in their 3225 report. Allow a framework for DEQ geographic response planning, specifically in the Deschutes River Basin. That is a very sensitive area. To this date, DEQ does not have a response plan on file there. We all acknowledge that, and this bill would allow that to happen. Include DEQ, the Office of State Fire Marshal, Office of Emergency Management, local responders, tribal governments, all in planning and work to put together these contingency plans. And that's what you find in the Dash 8s. All of that is there. So all constituents, all stakeholders have a view, have a role in this. So. And again, I guess regarding the Washington rules, it's important to understand, or the Washington plans, that was a two-year process to get to where they are now. Those plans, that rule only took effect about a month ago, 2 months ago. So to, again, Representative McLean's point about litigation, the ink is hardly dried on these plans yet, so I think it's really premature to say that they won't be litigated. But my point is, I think we have the opportunity with the Dash 8s to make a really successful step forward to ensure natural resource protection, public safety in my area as well as across the state of Oregon. And I think as the federal rules come out, I think we'll have a very robust and thorough response and public safety plan in place. So that is all I have for you. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Cindy Roberts, do you want to come up? I've got some members waiting on another bill, but.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad with nearly 1,100 miles of track in Oregon, and we employ about 1,600 people, and we are critical to the infrastructure of this state. We've invested over $1 billion in the state and the infrastructure here for the last 10 years and have been trying to improve it all along. Unfortunately, we cannot legislate against accidents. What we can legislate is how we respond. In 2015, I was in this room talking to you about House Bill 3225, which was an agreement that we all came to, and it was a great process and a great result, and I was happy to be here then. I'm not as happy to be here now. I will tell you a couple things. I want to respond directly. First of all, we have filed, my understanding is all four of the railroads in Washington did file their contingency plans. They have not been accepted yet. They have not been approved, but they have been filed. I want to be really clear. By cooperating, we are not conceding that it is legal. We are complying with the law while we wait for the federal government to pass their regulations, which could actually be more intense than those. And they've only the Hazardous Material Pipeline and Hazardous Material Association that does this just sent out rulemaking notice July of 2016. So it has not been in the works for years. It was in July of 2016. It's supposed to be done in August of 2017. I can get you the list of what those will entail. We're waiting to see what happens there. We're waiting to see what happens in other states. We are complying with the law because that's what we do. Couple other things. As far as the preemption of the law and this thought that Legislative Council looked at it and they're okay, Legislative Council was very clear. There's some significant problems with the bill. There's some significant questions about the legality. So they were upfront about that. And third, the fact that the bill itself doesn't say that you have to have approval to operate here, it sets standards. It allows the DEQ to set standards. If there's standards in the law where you're going to work, what you have to do, that's the same as binding us to do something for approval. If we didn't do it, what would happen? Nothing? And if nothing would happen, what's the point of putting it in the law? So to say that just because there's no approval doesn't mean that there's a problem. Real quickly, UP believes that consistency is the key to safety and security. That is why we believe different rules in different states do not help our operations, our crews, or our communities. This is why the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act of 1995 contains an express preemption clause which provides the Surface Transportation Board's jurisdiction over transportation by rail carriers. UP does believe that there are ways to handle this without the two major preemptions that we see. One is with the Federal Rail Safety Act, which says that safety laws cannot be put into place where the federal government already has the regulations covering the subject matter. The other is the Interstate Commerce Commission that says that states are preempted from state economic regulation of federal rail operators or any pre-clearance requirements. So those were the two big federal issues, but we do believe there's a way to do this without federal issues, without getting into the legal problems. And that's what the Dash 3s and the Dash 8s do. They address the things that you all said you wanted to have done. That is having OSFM do statewide training and have more work done on a comprehensive level. I think if you ask the OSFM, they would say we've been fabulous partners in this. As a matter of fact, not only did the rail help with equipment after 2015, but we also had promised that we would help with the facility training center. We just gave that to them. So we've been good partners. I know I'm almost done. We've okay. been really good partners. So we provide OSFM with the information they need. We provide them with, in the Dash 3s and Dash 8s, we provide the DEQ a role in geographic response planning and in soil, water, and air testing afterwards. And we also make sure that we're including local governments and tribal governments in all this work. We are committed to making sure that we do something that's safe for everyone, but we want it to be legal as well. And if the challenge here that you're hearing is that this is about having to request the information rather than having the rail provide it, we're happy to change the language in the Dash 8s to make it clear that rail must provide on a regular basis this information to the state fire marshal.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom Barrows representing BNSF Railway. We've been working on this as well, trying to come up with something that is doable. Regarding the California suit, that was dismissed, but it was dismissed because there had been no damage at that point, as the representative mentioned. That doesn't mean that we're not going to file suit again. Same in Washington. We've submitted a contingency plan, but it has not been accepted until we kind of know what the parameters are. We're not going to make a decision on a lawsuit there. And we're also waiting to see what the August rules are from the federal government, because that may inform what we do there. A couple quick things. Agree with consistency. It takes pieces of Washington, but they're very different structures, and so we don't think that this amendment really follows Washington. It takes pieces out of different portions and tries to put them into a system that doesn't quite fit, because in Washington, hazardous materials are in ecology. I mean, hazardous the hazmat crews are in, and here it's in the fire marshal. So we think fire marshal is a better location for these. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. Short.
Real short. Yeah, the plan that Representative Johnson was talking about coming out in August, is that a modification or is that a whole new original plan? Because it seems like they would have had something already in place, and is this just an advanced?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, that is actually an enhancement of a current plan. The pipeline and hazardous material already has a plan, but this is enhancing it. I think that it's important to note that while states may feel like they don't have a say, they do, and the federal government hears you, and they're upping their game with those rules.
Thank you.
Thank you. We got to find a member. We are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move that the Dash 8 amendment be adopted and the House Bill 2131 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative McLean has moved that, or do you need to?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we need to one motion at a time. So you need to move.
Yeah, didn't
amendment.
I move first?
Yeah, but we don't have that. We haven't adopted the.
Oh, we just adopted the Dash 8 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Aaron, you're right. Madam Chair, I move that the Dash 8 amendment be adopted.
Vice Chair McLean has moved the Dash 8 amendments be adopted. Sam, can you call the roll, please?
Can we discuss?
Oh, discuss. Sorry. I was getting ahead of myself. Okay. Mike started it.
Yep. Do you want to start?
Well, my only reason is that given the federal laws and the cost, I'm concerned about the cost. But bottom line is, while your presentation I thought was very good, it's based upon the Washington State statute. That's not been tested. Preemption is an issue. I'm worried about litigation on this thing, and it sounds to me like the Dash 8 is going to be streamlined, won't be a legal cost, and will be consistent with what our federal laws that would provide the answer here.
Thank you, and I would also like to call out Representative Johnson for his continued work on this issue. I feel strongly that it's I think it's important for us to have, a consistent West Coast approach, which to do this, and this does not do, the Dash 8s really, they allow the state to ask for stuff, and I would argue that I don't know why we could change that to require rail to provide it. Why wouldn't that be a preemption? If we can't require it if we can't require them to do it in one set of amendments, we wouldn't be able to require them to do it in another. So, I just I appreciate the motion, and I would just oppose the motion.
Further discussion. All right, now Sam, can you call the roll?
Representative Brew.
Aye.
Representative
Mack.
Aye. Representative Holby.
No.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
No.
Representative Smith Warner.
No.
Yes.
No.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2131.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2131. Is there discussion?
I just reincorporate my last comments. I am a little. I'm concerned about litigation, to be frank. And you know, it gets expensive when we have a federally regulated issue here. I'm concerned that in an earnest desire to want to do some good here, we're just stepping on a money pit, and I just don't think that's good policy at this point.
And I would respectfully say that is the standard response to any attempt to pass legislation. Is that it will be federally preempted, and I believe that we have a very strong case. The Oil Pollution Act, as I said, we've worked extensively with, and I believe I would even argue that if these federal ones come down, we have a preliminary opinion that these could very well not be preempted by that federal legislation as well. And I just don't think we can afford to wait to get moving on these contingency plans when we have had demonstrated the need, our need to broaden them.
In Madam Chair, I might add that while characterized as a standard response, it's nevertheless sincerely held. You know, we are in an environment where every penny is mattered. And thank you.
Further discussion? All right, Sam, can you call the roll, please?
No.
Representative Hack?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Noakes?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Yes.
Vice Chair McLean?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Blanchard?
Yes. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2131 with the due pass as amended recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 2131 as amended with a due pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Sam, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Rhodes?
No.
Representative Hack?
No.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
No.
Representative Noakes?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Yes.
Vice Chair McLean?
No.
Vice Chair Rachel?
Yes.
Chair Williamson?
Yes. Motion passes. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2131. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3078. Bite up Senator Winters. Thank you for being patient, Senator. I know it's usually not in your DNA. That's why I'm thanking you publicly for your patience. Mr. Schmidt, welcome. All right.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson. And I will be brief.
Does Representative Peluso want to join the dais? Okay. Here for support. All right. Thank you.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, House Bill 3078 with the, and for the record, I'm Jackie Winters, a state senator for District 10. House Bill 3078 with the Dash 2 amendments addresses cost containment issues and represents a bipartisan approach to investing in sound public safety policy. As co-chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, I have worked with and led public safety and human service policy and budget efforts in this building for over 18 years. I know the stakeholders in this arena, and I cherish my long-standing relationships with them. I also know the need to hold people accountable, to provide victims with the tools essential to rebuilding their lives, and to acknowledge the devastating consequences of incarceration on children and families and the intergenerational cycle of incarceration that will continue if we fail to further invest in justice reinvestment programs. The Dash 2 amendments is the product of 6 weeks of deliberation by a work group of public safety stakeholders led by former Judiciary Chair Lane Cheddarly and Greg McPherson. While their recommendations in this document are not yet consensus, two realities are acknowledged. We must bend the cost curve in spending taxpayer dollars in all areas of the state budget, including prisons. Let's be clear. Census at the women's prison is still over capacity and putting inmates and workers at risk. However, opening a new women's prison would cost taxpayers at least $17.5 million per biennium. House Bill 3078 is about being right and smart on crime by investing in local communities to provide the accountability, treatment, rehabilitation, and services needed to prevent future crimes, especially addiction-driven property crime. What does the bill do? House Bill 3078, with the proposed Dash 2 amendments, adopts the Public Safety Work Group recommendations, including expanding the family sentencing alternatives to keep families together and extend short-term transition leave to 120 days. Many of you are aware of the family sentencing alternative. Short-term transition leave is a successful program that transitions eligible people back to the community with necessary supervision and services, currently allowed up to 90 days prior to release. House Bill 3078 would allow, and I want to repeat this, up to 120 days. And to be clear, the language in the bill is may, not shall. Creating a statewide 416 program. 416 programs already divert Measure 57 drug and property offenders from prison to treatment and services in the community, and currently operate, and I'm very pleased to say, in my county, in Marion County, when we could not pass 416, I believe it was in 2013, Marion County, with the forward thinking of my sheriff and my district attorney, began implementing components of House 416. And so currently in Marion County, Klamath, and Lane counties, there are efforts underway to actually do Senate Bill 416. Multnomah County is also currently doing some of the iterations and modifications to test the process. Restoring the crimes of theft one and ID theft to mandatory sentences of 13 months. Theft one and ID theft are the primary drivers of the women's prison population. While Measure 57 was intended to punish big-time drug dealers and con artists, these charges are picking up some nonviolent addicts and low-level offenders and those individuals. And primarily, there's a lot of women. And women, as we know, and those that we have talked to, that are in Coffee Creek, that feeding one's habit of substance abuse also means sometimes that these individuals are also committing the crime of theft, theft one and ID theft. While these crimes will remain felonies, we don't change that in this bill. They still will be a felony with mandatory prison sentence of 13 months. However, the Dash 2 amendments allows us to invest, and I want to repeat that, to invest in treatment and rehabilitations needed to turn their lives around. Colleagues, it has bothered me over all these years that I have worked with both Children's Services, foster care, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the prison population, to find that we do not do the investment on the front end, nor the investment that is needed to make certain individuals are provided those services so they don't return to prison. I think we've heard testimony after testimony, whether it is in some of the cases in DHS and foster care, whether it's listening to those in OYA, or whether it is listening to our population, both female and male alike, that are in our prison population. And I submit, unless we begin to address some of the root causes that exist, we will continue to overpopulate our prison system. Perhaps most importantly, savings from this measure would be reinvested into local communities through the Justice Reinvestment and Victim Services. We know that investment in justice reinvestment initiatives reduce future costs to the state and are necessary to keep communities safe, and that we are currently not even close to being able to adequately fund costs of victim services. I am very proud to have a broad coalition in support of the Dash 2 amendments. While we are limited on time for testimony today, I would like to personally hand out, and I know that there's some handouts here, of testimony from AOI, OBA, and the Oregon Business Council supporting the Dash 2 amendments. Colleagues, and I'm going to, you know, talk as one who's worked with a lot of you over the years, I really urge you to seriously think about what I've said in this testimony. We can be smarter on crime than what we have been. We can, if we want to really do it, make the kind of investments to our communities to make certain that we are providing dollars for treatment and wraparound services and those things that this building talks about a lot. Those things that we know when we talk about best practices that we know that work. And so, you know, my conversation to you today and after the weeks and months of working with the stakeholders on this particular package and listening to the statistics, and what's the most troubling is that the statistics are suggesting, with the overcrowding and the increase in the numbers of women that are at Coffee Creek, that, you know, and I've said time and time again, I happen to be one who was here in the 70s that did the study of the women's prison, the one that they're now talking about trying to reopen. And I've said, I hope I never see that day when we go back to doing that. And so I implore you and I urge you to actually vote to adopt the House Bill 3078 with the Dash 2 amendments and to send this bill on to Ways and Means to continue this important conversation.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. It was my role on the Speaker's Task Force as a representative of the Criminal Justice Commission to provide information and data as the committee considered the various changes that ultimately ended up being put into this bill and in their memo. So I'm here today to talk about or to answer any questions that people have regarding any of the data. But as a position, I'm the CJC is neutral on the legislation.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, thank you, Madam Chair. flip of the tongue. I just want to, you know, commend you for all your attention and work to this. I know we from time to times agree and disagree throughout our history here. But on this one, I am totally in agreement with you. I was really moved by when we went on the Ways and Means tour around the state and listening to some of the women that came forward with their children and that family program. Just really important, makes a huge difference in the lives of not just the incarcerated women that are coming out back into society, but also their families. And so can't be in more support of this than I am. I just really thank you for your work.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward. And I heard the other side a little bit, too, and I just wanted to ask you that the forecast, I think the Department of Corrections forecast for the next 10 years was that there would be another 11, it would take another 11 beds, I think, in the women's prison. So the consideration of opening up another prison isn't real likely an argument against the bill. And then the other thing I wanted to know is if by reducing sentences in the past in other legislation, have we reduced the crime rate? I think there's another bill in 2013 where we reduce sentencing, and I don't think it's affected the cost or the crime rate has declined. So it's one of the things that it seems like what we do in here and what we've looked at even in the last couple sessions that I've been in is increasing fines for different offenses, especially game offenses. You know, we've increased the penalties for poaching game, and we were looking at increasing the penalties for texting on your phone, and all of these bills that we bring forth as a deterrent. So it's just a question. I understand the thrust of this bill, and I would like to say, hey, if this works, that's great. If it doesn't, the other question is, it's a pilot. How long does it go for, and for how long is it tested?
I won't. I'll let my learned colleague to address one of your questions. But the question of whether or not we're at the threshold of opening up another prison, we are there. I don't know the statistics that you've seen, but you know the bed capacity, and I'm sure that the good director of CJC will verify this. I think I got statistics today that we're using emergency beds, and so that is a reality. And the other thing, and I think the recognition and understanding. When I looked at the stats and looking at two things, not only looking at the offense that was created, but also looking at what actually was involved with the individual and the offense. And you will find that with most of the Theft One, and I'm sure that it'll be verified, Theft One and the ID Fit, also along with that is substance abuse and other issues. We have a serious problem with substance abuse, and it seems to me, and I've been, looking at other states and some of the things that we're doing, and particularly with the whole issue of Smart on Crime. Smart on Crime came about because it was a recognition that those of us who were involved with policy and making, and those of us who are having to pay, the taxpayers having to pay the bill, have asked ourselves the question, is it more more cost effective, both from the dollar standpoint as well as the humane standpoint, to actually treat the problem with alcohol and drug treatment rather than it costs you less to do that than it does to have a jail cell, a bail bed out at DOC? Is what we're doing actually, we have been doing the incarceration and what have you long, and we're not winning this war. We're not winning this battle. So to me, it asks, is there a better way? We also know, and I think in talking to some of my local, my sheriff and others, where they've started doing 416 and the work that they're doing, that they are having some successes. Just as we're having some success in drug courts, just as we're having some success where we know that we can change the behavior of individuals, that we can divert and make certain that people are not going into DOC. And I think that it is. I have a lot of faith in the work that our communities are doing around the state. And I think when we actually talk to them, but the big issue there in allowing them to do their work is that for us to provide the resources for them to do the job that we have asked them to do.
A quick follow-up. Thank you. Certainly, I would love to see the same outcome as you do. So my argument isn't with that. It's with statistics that we've had so far and has it worked. So thank you.
Thank you. And colleagues, just so you know, I've talked about the proponents and opponents of this bill. They've agreed to a 15-minute panel each, so you can plan your evenings, because I know people are wondering what the plan is because of floor. So thank you very much, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. I don't have the names in front of me. So here we go. Sarah Brennan, Shannon White, and Scott Taylor. And Aaron will be keeping time, so you can go for 5 minutes each, or you can do 15 minutes, however you want to split it up. But she's going to cut you off 15 minutes. Put her handy dandy. Are you going to put your timer up? She'll put a timer up, just so you know.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair McLean and Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Scott Taylor. I'm the director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, which is probation and parole, both on the adult and probation and detention on the juvenile. And we are here today to strongly support House Bill 3078 because it encompasses several key elements that strengthen our effort to deliver effective supervision and services to justice-involved individuals in Multnomah County. Proposed changes to the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, and expansion of the short-term transitional leave, and changes in sentencing length for property offenses will enhance our ability to deliver wraparound services to those under our supervision. Multnomah County began development and implementation of wraparound with the Reentry Enhancement Coordination Program, which was run by DOC out into the communities, and it delivered wraparound services such as housing, treatment, mentoring, and people getting out of prison. In 2011, the Criminal Justice Commission did a study of that program. And what they found was that the participants in the program had a recidivism rate of 16% compared to a recidivism rate of 28% in the control group. That's a 40-some percent shift in recidivism. Because of the success of the REC program, a major component of the Multnomah County Justice Reinvestment Program is delivering wraparound services. As a recent study shows, participants on supervision had similar or better recidivism rates than participants in the pre-justice reinvestment comparison group. This underscores the effectiveness of this program and why we are leading the state in fewer prison bed commitments. This bill will eliminate some of the statutory restrictions to program participation in the FSAP and broaden the number of counties eligible to participate. Multnomah County is one of five counties participating in the current Family Sentencing Alternative Program pilot, and during 2016, 75 participants engaged in the program statewide, affecting the lives of 139 folks. And these folks would have ended up in the foster care system. In Multnomah County, we were able to handle 30 individuals that have participated in the program. Currently, the barriers include disqualification due to crime and because of an individual is pregnant and not yet considered to be parenting. We could serve many more participants and possibly even have a wait list for this program if these barriers were removed. The most important aspect of the program is that participants are able to continue parenting their children in the community, not housed in the prison. Participants are assessed and then receive intensive supervision, wraparound services, and DCJ manages these individuals in the community with the help of our public safety partners and DHS. This bill is also proposing to expand short-term transitional leave beyond the current 90-day maximum for certain specified sentences. Multnomah County strongly supports that any increase in short-term transitional leave because it has been the single most successful strategy for House Bill 3194, known as Justice Reinvestment. In 2017, a review by the Criminal Justice Commission, inmates who participate in the short-term transitional leave program show lower 1 and 2 year recidivism rates than inmates who were statutory eligible and did not participate. For Multnomah County, between 2014 and 2016, 32,000 prison bed days have been saved as a result of inmates released to short-term transitional leave, allowing the Department of Corrections to avoid spending another $3.2 million in operation costs. When looking at statewide prison bed use across counties, Multnomah County continues to consistently lead in the reduction of prison bed usage to help state reach the reduction numbers. And lastly, we're supportive of the proposed reductions in the sentence length because the research continues to demonstrate that swift and certain and not graduated continued growth of sentencing actually has a more positive effect. Multnomah County wraparound model continues to have excellent results when compared with a prison first model. For example, we have a higher percentage of risk of people of high risk on our supervision than the state average, yet our recidivism rates for high risk is considerably lower than the state average. To reiterate, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice strongly supports this bill because of the changes proposed to work to strengthen our ability to deliver wraparound services and probationers and parolees and keep them in their home community where they will all return. I get them back either way. So thank you for the opportunity.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Brennan. I'm the operations manager at the Center for Hope and Safety. Our agency serves survivors of domestic and sexual violence here in Marion County, and I have been an advocate with the group for over 11 years. I am here to voice our support in House Bill 3078 with the Dash 2 amendment. One of the opportunities I have had as an advocate over the past few years is to work with individuals at Coffee Creek. We were invited in to do a series of discussions with a group of women on healthy relationships, the dynamics of domestic violence, and various other topics. One of the things that I was really fascinated by is that all of the women that we worked with while we were there had domestic violence or sexual assault in their history. Many of them, it was the domestic violence relationship that led them into whatever had them incarcerated. One example that stood out was a woman whose abuser had convinced her to plead guilty to a crime that he committed because he said they'd go easier on her. It would have been his third strike. And so out of love for him and an attempt to hold her family together and keep him out of prison, she pled guilty and ended up serving time. Many of the women also mentioned to us that they didn't know that programs like ours existed. While we have been around for a long time and there are programs like ours across the state, most people don't know about us until they need us. And I firmly believe that with additional outreach and education around the dynamics of domestic violence, and as women are able to see the resources that are available to them, moving out of a domestic violence relationship is going to be key for them. And I really I see oftentimes that the incarcerated women are there not because of criminal thinking errors, but because they put their trust in the wrong person. And that can be really tough. So I really encourage you to support House Bill 3078 with the Dash 2 amendment and honor these individuals and let them build on their resiliency and strength and give them the resources they need to prosper. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a nonprofit that advances solutions to crime that ensure justice, equity, accountability, and healing. We're here today in strong support of the Dash 2 amendments that came out of the work group, as you heard, headed up by Lane Shetterly and Greg McPherson. But we do want to say that the original bill that we brought forward with Representatives Peluso and Sanchez and others, we believe that was a good bill, too, and that asked for reforms to all of Measure 57, and this bill decidedly does not do that. So. This is a compromise from where we believe we can go, but we certainly understand compromise is a part of what happens in the legislature. So we are here in support, but also want to make clear that this is not a repeal of Measure 57. This is a tweak to the two crimes that are the biggest drivers of the female prison population, as well as doing what Scott was mentioning, strengthening families through the Family Sentencing Alternative Program and building on what early data shows is very successful at reducing recidivism, the short-term transition leave. And this, you know, this bill really builds on the bill that Rep. Barreto mentioned earlier, House Bill 3194, the Justice Reinvestment Act in 2013. And while it takes a long time to see data, the preliminary data on that is good. We have been reducing incarceration and crime and recidivism is down in many of the counties that are doing the deepest work, as in Multnomah County, Marion County, Lane County have all shown great results with the very policies that are just being sort of expanded and embedded in this bill. So nothing new and frightening is happening. This is actually work that we've seen, in fact, led by and large by law enforcement to enact these programs in their counties. And we just want to make it more possible to go statewide. So there are those reforms that have been talked about. Again, you'll see in the bill that there are reinvestments into justice reinvestment, as well as the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. And we believe this is a thoughtful and carefully constructed package to do modest reforms to impact particularly the female prison population and to get resources to the local communities who need it to do the most effective work that they can do, as Scott mentioned. I want to address a little bit of what I think you're going to hear from the opponents to this bill, because we've had another hearing. And there's some things that I think need to be addressed. One is that sort of incarceration has made Oregon safer. And I just want to note that while Oregon is a relatively safe state, 31 states in the last 8 years have both cut their incarceration rate and their crime rate at the same time. We are not that state. We have actually what we did with 3194 was actually flatline prison growth, but not reduce it. Other states, 31 other states, have reduced it and have seen drops in crime as well. And it's also important to remember that incarceration disproportionately impacts communities of color, and Oregon ranks for our disproportionate incarceration of African Americans, and that is something that we have to start addressing and taking seriously. Another thing you might hear is that we're not talking about victims. First of all, there's a in your just checking the time here. In the OLIS materials, you'll see a survey, a national victim survey of crime victims' attitudes towards the justice system. And there are, you know, we want to be really clear. There are a huge range of victim voices, and there's not one victim voice. And some, they can have a range of different positions. But some findings ring out in this particular survey that most victims prefer a system that focuses on rehabilitation more than punishment. Most victims don't get the services they need, which is why we're trying to increase funding for victim services. And by a 3-1 margin, victims prefer accountability to happen through options other than prison. As you can see, we have victim advocates who are with us in support of this bill, as they were with House Bill 3194. You have also heard many of the women incarcerated, most that we hear, have histories of victimization themselves. Some might say these aren't real victims because now they've been convicted of a crime, but we and our victim services allies believe that you are still a victim even if you get convicted of a crime as well. And again, the justice reinvestment, along again with our victim services allies, lobbied hard for that bill to include 10% of its funding to go to victim services. So we are talking about victims, we are advocating for victims and keeping them front and center of the work we do. You also might hear that many of the women in prison have multiple convictions, and that is true. And that should make us ask how we can do this work better. We know that these crimes that we're addressing with this bill are largely addiction-driven, and that we need to do something other than cycle people in and out of jails. And we think the approaches laid out here are most effective. And finally, I just want to address the women's prison population and that it may not be growing to the past capacity. I think Representative Rayfield, when you and I met over the summer, the DOC was about to open the prison, and it was a sure thing because we were at 1,280 people, because that is absolute maximum capacity. Today we're at 1,303, and it's been on the steady rise for the last few weeks. So we're in a state of perpetual crisis around this. We already have, I believe, 120 emergency beds being used there, and so that is why we are here bringing this bill of what we think are modest reforms. And so I want to say, you know, the people who are going to oppose the bill are all the prosecutors over here, and they are doing, I've been thinking about why are they so opposed to this stuff, and part of it is, I think, they are on the front lines of the worst moments in people's lives. They see people who have done the worst thing and have received the worst harm and are doing really important work in that position. But I wonder if also they don't actually get to see the strength and resilience and potential of these people and how important it is that we invest in it. Not long ago, someone in my own family ended up convicted of a crime, and I saw how desperately the system wouldn't look at the things that made that young person resilient. The fact that he was an honor student, a soccer player, in the high school musical were completely disregarded for the consequences that he was held accountable for. Did he make a bad choice? Absolutely. Should he have been, you know, held accountable? For sure. But we need to do our accountability in ways that build on people's resilience and the strengths of our communities and families. And that's why we bring these policies before you. And so I just want to make clear that this is rooted in like values of believing that all these people who return to our communities are worth investing in. We need to put the resources there, and we need to have a system that makes sure that they can grow and thrive. And so I urge your aye support for the dash two amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much. Bradbury, Walt Biglow, and Steve Dole. Again, as with the last panel, 15 minutes, you can split it up however you want.
Is the stopwatch started?
On it.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. I'm Brad Beery. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and here representing both myself, my county, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I will start with, as you probably know, we oppose House Bill 3078, and with or without the dash two amendments. I will also point out that Tim Colahan is here. He's executive director of the DA's Association, and since there isn't time, he will be submitting written testimony, and I refer you to look at that also. A little bit about me. I'm in my 21st year as the elected district attorney in Yamhill County. I also had about 3 years as a deputy DA, and also point out that I spent 12 years in private practice, where about a third of my practice was doing criminal defense work. So I've done both sides. I've been on both ends of council table. As I talk about these issues, I want to remind you that all counties are different, but we, the district attorneys, have all worked really hard with our community partners to leverage state JRI, the Justice Reinvestment Funds, to substantially shift the trajectory of people going to prison. Collaboration has led to change in who we send to prison. I'll give you a couple examples from Yamhill County, because those are the ones I deal with, that I can tell you what we've done. JRI monies have been used to increase supervision resources in our county so that we have appropriate supervision for those that we keep and don't send otherwise presumptively prison-bound individuals. We've invested in treatment programs, including cognitive and behavioral treatment programs that work towards dealing with criminality, towards criminogenic needs, not just substance abuse. We have significant substance abuse treatment programs in Yamhill County. I would point out not all counties have the resources that we do. We now have a process where every felony property offender in Yamhill County who is presumptively prison bound is, before plea offers are made and before end results of those cases are done, are subjected to an analysis. They're interviewed and they are rated on their the criminogenic needs. And I do want to point out, when I talk about those, there are four criminogenic factors that are deemed more accurate in predicting recidivism than substance abuse. It's about the fifth one on the list. But this information is made available to the state, to the court, and to the defense in trying to determine whether or not individuals who would otherwise be prison-bound can be safely supervised in the community. This has reduced the number of people that we are sending to prison. And this is done with all of our property offenders, men and women. And in fact, it's been updated to have female-specific criminogenic review for women also. And that has actually further reduced those that we send. Our programs and those of the other counties are just really getting going. And we look forward to seeing whether or not they will be successful. We need time to see how the programs are working, to get data, and actually show whether or not the programs we're trying to do, rather than what has been argued as the same old approach, whether or not our results are better or not. And if they're not, I've been candid with my community, then we need to find better programs that will give us better results, not just keep doing what we've been doing. Yamhill County, like most counties, is already making every effort to handle property offenders at the community level. The system is operating well, and the proposals here, I think, can have the potential of upsetting the balance. Lengthening transitional leave is not only a poor policy choice. Aside from the fact that it is simply too large a sentence cut, it will upset the apple cart even further by how we try to deal with offenders in an appropriate way. Many local programs are at their capacity. In talking with the district attorney from Eugene, she indicated that this will put added pressures on their housing, on their treatment resources, and healthcare resources that they have by having individuals back in the community sooner. I want to point out here that a little thing that I did in my county. About 6 months ago, I went and looked to see the property offenders that we had sent to prison, and I asked the Criminal Justice Commission to tell me the last 50 that we had done. I pulled each and every file on each and every offender that we had. The issue that I wanted to look at was where it's always argued we should give treatment, not just send people to prison. And so I looked at it. The average offense, the average prior criminal conduct, prior record for them was 3.84 property crimes before they were sent to prison. Of those that were in need of treatment, there were five of the 50 I couldn't tell whether they'd ever had treatment or not, principally because their prior record was out of state. I had two that had no treatment issues related to substance abuse, which left 41. Of those, 95.4% of those that we sent to prison had had prior treatment or been ordered to do treatment from prior convictions and had not done it. We are giving treatment to these individuals before they go to prison. They're not going to prison because they have substance abuse issues. They're going because they choose also to commit other crimes. House Bill 3194 provided us new resources to allow communities to target these offenders and to rehabilitate them. Let's give it time to work. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and Vice Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. My name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United was founded in 1983 and is the largest standing crime victims organization representing victims of all crime in Oregon. Crime Victims United strongly opposes House Bill 3078 and the proposed Dash 2 amendments. I first testified on this bill on April 12th in the House Judiciary Committee. Much like today, prior to my turn to speak, I heard over and over again that we are facing a crisis at Coffee Creek, Oregon's only women's prison. Absent immediate reductions in sentences and expansions of back-end cuts, the prison will burst at the seams. This is simply not the case. My last testimony was 10 days after the April prison forecast. I've submitted this forecast to the committee administrator, and it should be on OLIS. This is it. I suggest you turn to page 9 and look at the highlighted section. I didn't make this up. This is a bipartisan committee from many different areas of the criminal justice community. And it's estimated that 11 additional female inmates over the next decade. Yes, that's right, 11. That's one new bed per year over a 10-year period. The notion we are on the cusp of opening a women's prison is a narrative that is not supported by the facts. It is being leveraged to achieve an ideological end. That end is cutting sentences. And not just cutting women's sentences, but cutting the sentences of hundreds, if not thousands, of male offenders. What's more, in this case, it cuts sentences that were overwhelmingly approved by Oregon voters. Voters who were tired of being victimized. Voters who were tired of walking to work or losing their jobs because they could not afford to replace their stolen car. Tired of losing their savings and their credit because of identity thieves. Tired of being afraid that the burglar will be back for a second bite at the apple and that maybe next time the kids or grandmother may be home. And it may be much worse than a burglary, a home invasion robbery, or even worse. These are Oregonians in the criminal justice system who are the victims, and they're unfortunately rarely discussed in this building nowadays. For nearly 25 years, I have been involved in protecting victims and the rights of crime victims, victims of violent crime, victims of property crime, all victims. I do it because I know the crime puts a tremendous burden on victims and their families. It is frequently financially devastating. It is often emotionally shattering. In some cases, far more frequently than you think, it causes victims to enter a life-altering downward spiral that leads to divorce, drugs, and unfortunately even death. It touches every victim differently, but it touches them all. They don't get any good time. They don't get any short-term transitional leave. They don't get any family leave. They live with it. Nowadays, when I come to Salem, I'm troubled, I'm shocked by what I see and hear. It is the offenders who are now viewed as the victims. They can't get housing, they can't find jobs, they lose custody of their children, they're addicts, they need certificates of good standing, they need a bill of rights, they need to get out of prison early. Is it hard for offenders to get back on track? I'm sure it is. But I promise you, it is no harder than it is for many innocent victims, innocent Oregonians, to pick up the pieces of their lives. And it's just not victims of violent crime, it's victims of all crimes. If you are thinking about voting yes on this bill, I would ask you to take one simple step before you do. Spend a day at the Crime Victims Assistance Office at your local district attorney. Talk to the victims. Ask them about their families. Ask them about their lives. Ask them about the challenges they face. Ask them what they've been through. Spend some time with them. Spend as much time as you do thinking about and talking about criminals. Should we help offenders get on the right path? Absolutely. But not at the expense of more victims. And that is where this bill does not measure up. And that is where this bill will take us. Removing or limiting law enforcement's tools to incarcerate criminals, career criminals, for sufficient periods of time to either participate in custody treatment programs or age out of criminal behavior is inappropriate and furthermore dangerous. Cutting sentences on the back end through programs such as expanded transitional leave is dishonest to the public and dismissive of Oregon voters. Don't be fooled by misdirection. We don't have an incarceration program or problem, excuse me. We have a crime problem. This is an ideological bill built on a false narrative of a prison crisis. If you don't see it through it, the voters will. Crime Victims United urges you to oppose House Bill 3078. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Walt Beglaw. I serve as the District Attorney of Marion County for about 13 years and in the DA's office for about 28. Thanks for your attention this evening. Historically, Marion County has been, by every measure, a heavy user of Oregon's prisons. Prior to October of 2014, we were in that red bar that you've seen on the CJC, Criminal Justice Commission, compared to the baseline. But I have to say today, I'm surprised by our community's productivity. We are in the green and a marked improvement. And if you look at the statistics that we have, we are saving from the baseline over 44,000 months of prison as of today's date. And I have to say that these are the direct result of the leadership of our Board of Commissioners, our sheriff, and our community stakeholders diving in to produce on justice reinvestment programs. And secondly, the resources that this legislature deployed in that direction. So, and the goal there was to reduce prison use and have community programs that were productive. And that's what we have accomplished to date. Our flagship program, you've heard a bit about, it's 416, takes prison-bound Measure 57 median and high-risk offenders, does not put them in prison, and places them on very deliberately tailored community supervision plans. We are now diverting over 60 offenders upfront from prison every year with promising results. And we have a RCT, a random controlled trial, that is being produced right now to look at that program to make sure our outcomes are succeeding. Sentencing reductions contemplated in 3078 undermine the capacity and incentive to maintain, develop, and implement programs like 416. The emerging success of these programs actually depends on the sentencing provisions of Measure 57 as they exist today. They depend on transitional leave components vital to negotiate and incentivize partition in community programs and depend upon sustained investments in justice reinvestment. Our family sentencing program, the alternatives, and other strategies are addressed to meet the female prison population. We have cut that in half in Marion County, those intakes. And so increased flexibility within those provisions will encourage participation. So LEAD, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, other tools and programs designed to address substance abuse, mental illness, will all invariably impact those the trajectory of prison and will succeed. That said, justice reinvestment needs time to mature. Local communities have developed very innovative programs, and they are eager and motivated to replicate those successes. So we have promising early returns, and as many have said, go local, buy local. That's where it's working. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
Just one question, I guess. As I look at this, it appears that it probably violates Measure 57.
What was it?
Violates, is this consistent with Measure 57, or does it violate it?
Chair Williamson, representative and members of the committee, it changes Measure 57. So the two provisions related to theft one and identity theft would change the sentences set forth in Measure 57 from, I think they're currently at 18 months to 13 months. In addition to that, if you look on the back end, when Measure 57 was passed, short-term transitional leave was 30 days. It was expanded to 90 days. 2 years ago, and now you're talking 120 days. So you take a 13-month sentence. If you went from 18 months down to 13 months, the actual time served would be someplace around 6 or 7 months of what was originally thought by the voters to be an 18-month sentence.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I don't think Senator Winters answered was, this is a pilot program, and then it says that it will be evaluated no later than January 1st of each year. So I guess a pilot program can go on for a long time, but in your experience, and when you look at recidivism, how long does it usually take, you know, to evaluate whether a program is working or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I'll just use 416 as an example. We've had that essentially up and running since 2013. We're almost halfway through a random controlled trial, which is the gold standard in evaluating a program. We've had hundreds of individuals go through that program, and we won't complete that process unlikely until early of 2019 when we get 300. That's the magic number. 300 participants in that random controlled trial. So the very flagship, the very front end savings from prison use and directed at the heart of substance abuse and property crime is taking us years to make sure we get the right outcomes, and that's when we'll have that answer. So the bottom line is the rest of these programs, it's far too premature to say that they are working or not working until we have better opportunity to evaluate them. And that's part of our case here.
Follow up on that. So are there other states that have had these programs in place that have had the years, like this is 6 years you're talking about to evaluate it? Do you look at other states and how it's worked there?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I suspect the Criminal Justice Commission has looked at similar programs nationally, and they could really probably respond to that pretty effectively. It hasn't been quite 6 years. It was 2013 we got started, and the random controlled trial has been going for a shorter period of time, I think about 18 months. But again, it takes time to effectively analyze programs and their true success.
Mike, do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto.
Oh, got to get in front of the mic.
Mike Schmidt, Criminal Justice Commission, again. And oh, Representative Barreto, we have looked at the most studied interventions in criminal justice have really been drug courts, and there's a lot of research around drug courts for the past couple decades. The 416 program is not a drug court model, but it has some similar components to it. So I think when Marion County was developing that program, they borrowed from some of those practices. So I haven't seen another 416 national program anywhere else or research that I'm aware of. But we, DA Begelaw said, we're halfway through that. So we're hoping to add to it. The only other thing I'd say about studies is even studies in other states that show programs are effective or not, You really want to study it in Oregon to see if the same effect can be had on our populations, demographics and problems and every issues change. So you really want to make sure the program is studied locally if you can.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Question as it relates to the comment made about changing the sentencing from the 18 to the 13. You said essentially if you went to 13, it'd end up being 6 months. If it's currently 18, is it essentially 9 months?
Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, here's roughly the way you configure it. An individual who's sent to prison for an 18-month sentence will normally have done 1 or 2 months locally before they go. Not always, but sometimes. So you take your 18, comes down to 16. On the 18-month sentence, they will go in and be eligible for 20% earned time credit. So that's another, on an 18-month sentence, that's another almost, round numbers, 2 months that they would have off. So now we're down to a 18-month sentence is effectively down to, where'd I get, to 14 months. And then you would have, if you increase 4 months, 2 4-months on the transitional leave, that brings them down to about a 10-month sentence, if I kept my math straight there. Part of the problem and the issue comes here is that treatment programs take time. And in fact, we've actually had individuals who, when there was a 21-month to be eligible, I think it was for AIPs at one time, you had to have at least 21 months in. And we had defense attorneys say we were making offers of 18 months on it. Their client wanted the 21 months to be eligible for programming that otherwise they would not have been eligible for. In our drug courts, for example, the people in treatment, the average is 18 months. So if you want people to get treatment while they're at DOC, there has to be sufficient time for them to do it also.
I'm just going to, out of a bit of frustration with this whole eligible for programs, we just had a couple of gals come in and testify in another committee from Coffee Creek and had been in for a lot longer than 18 months and didn't qualify. So I got to tell you, I'm a bit frustrated with the idea that we have them, they're locked in, it's a captive audience, and they have to qualify for treatment is disheartening to me. I don't care if it's 6 months, I don't care if it's 18 months, I don't care if it's 24 months. That to me is wrong. I think that we ought to be looking at programs that treat them regardless of the time. I just think that's a cop-out to say that we can't treat people simply because they don't qualify when we have them and they're incarcerated. We should be treating them, period, and it shouldn't be a matter of qualification. But that, I'll get off that soapbox. One other question that I did have, were you involved in the work group and the work that was put into working on this piece of legislation?
Chair Williamson and Representative Hack, I was not personally, but I believe
Tim Callahan
was at the work group, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And he is Executive Director of Oregon District Attorney's Association.
Thank you.
Would you like to know if Crime Victims United was involved in the work group?
Hold on, I called on a member. Representative Rayfield.
So I just want to appreciate the work that Yamhill, Marion County, Multnomah County, and Lane County have done to reduce. I think you guys have done a very good job. But I also think that when we talk about reducing the jail population, at least the data that I have seen or looked at from the CJC is that most of the counties stayed the same, and quite frankly, some of them increased, right? And so when you're in a group like this, you bring your best players and the ones that are doing a really good job. So I just want to give you guys credit for that. But with that said, I actually want to, and Mike, since you're up here, I want to ask you a question in terms of, since you're the data guy, I know when we did criminal justice in the past, we reduced the ID theft from, what was it, from like 24 months down to 18 months, and there were some other changes and things like that. We've now come since 2013, we're now in 2017. Is there any data that indicates that the public is less safe than they were in the past?
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, that's a challenging question in terms of trying to get at the crime. Reported crime is typically how we would look at that. Unfortunately, we're missing a large portion of our state's reported crime numbers in 2015 and 2016. Which I would characterize as being particularly relevant as a lot of sentencing changes takes a little bit of time and programs take some time to factor in. We're hopeful that when that region system gets up and running, we'll be able to get at that information. But as of yet, we do not have that into our stats. So it's kind of in terms of whether or not crime is going up, we'd have to look at that. You know, since the 90s, crime is really at a the low end of the trough of where it had been really high. Property and person crimes in Oregon has pretty much at its lowest point in a long time. And even if they're, when we look at it county by county and those counties that are reporting, it's a mixed bag. Some counties are slightly up, some counties are slightly down.
Okay, very helpful.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I just was remiss in complimenting Marion County for the work that they have done, and I want to say thank you for all that you do.
Great, thank you. Additional questions? Yes, Representative Barreto.
Just one, and maybe not to the panel, but does this take a two-thirds majority if it affects Measure 57?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, vote of the House and the Senate, yes, it does.
That, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3078.
All right, Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 3078.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the dash two amendments into House Bill 3078. Is there any discussion? Sam, can you call the roll?
Is this for the
amendment?
The amendment,
the aye. Dash two.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative
Nose?
Yes.
Representative
Warren?
Aye.
Excused? Yes. Amendments adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3078 with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 3078 with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I'll be a no on this.
Further discussion? Okay. All right, Sam, can you call the roll, please?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
No.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative
Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean?
Excused.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Williamson?
Yes. Motion passes. With that, I'll close the public hearing, or I'm sorry, close the work session on 3078. And we are rolling over House Bill 3456 until Tuesday, the work session on 3456. Is there anything else?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we also carried over 3454 to Tuesday.
Yes, we carried over 3454, if you couldn't hear Aaron, to Tuesday. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you all for stay. With that, we are adjourned.